Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Who has a right to tell you what to do with your own body?
This tobacco product contains a drug called nicotine, which is addictive.
If it's my body, shouldn't I be the one who decides what it's okay to do with it?
If I had my way, I would say it is just as addictive as heroin or cocaine.
Does the government really need to protect me from myself?
While I am smoking cigarettes, I am not downing a bottle of scotch. So, looked at from that point of view, it's a health tool.
Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette. Puff, 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 and if you puff yourself to death.
Tell St. Peter at the Golden Gate that you just hate him, make him wait. But you just gotta have another cigarette.
Our guest is Cecile Fogg, author of Whose Body Is It Anyway? Justice and the Integrity of the Person.
Regulating Bodies, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Gotta smoke?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry.
And we're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. That's where Ken and I teach philosophy.
Today, regulating bodies.
Ken, nobody has a right to tell me what to do with my own body. That's obvious. Not even the government. It's my body, after all. I can do with it whatever I please.
But, John, there are mandatory seatbelt laws, prohibitions against prostitution, laws against the buying and selling of human organs. All that involves regulating the body. You see something wrong with that?
Well, I do. First of all, I and I alone have exclusive ownership of my body. If that's right, which it surely is, it follows pretty directly that as long as I'm not hurting anyone else, I should be left alone to do with my body as I please.
Well, John, but first of all, the state actually has an interest in seeing to it that its citizens remain healthy and able-bodied. Think of all the people who fight our wars or keep our streets safe or care for and educate our children. Where are those people going to come from if the state were to just sit back and allow us all to eat, drink, or drive ourselves to early graves?
You make the state sound like a hovering, hectoring helicopter parent.
Well, I'm not really arguing for paternalism. Not exactly, anyway. But look, just as the state has a legitimate claim to some of our financial resources, it also has a legitimate claim to our bodily resources, it seemed to me.
You're comparing regulation of the body to taxes? Oh, come on. You mean to say that the state can, legitimately take one of my arms or one of my kidneys and redistribute it to someone else?
Well, I'm not sure I'd go quite that far. But look, suppose that there was a blood shortage or a bone marrow shortage. What would be so wrong with the state actually compelling healthy people to donate blood or bone marrow to relieve the shortage?
Well, donating blood, donating bone marrow, those are good things, all for them. I don't object to the state encouraging people to do those good things. But compelling them? That goes too far.
Well, John, but wait a minute. Just leave the state out of it for a minute if that bothers you. Look at it from a moral point of view. There's a person right here, right now, who needs a blood transfusion, or he's going to die. He's going to die, John. If you could save him by giving a pint or two of your precious blood, aren't you morally obligated to do so?
If I don't give my blood, and I just let this poor person die, then you could rightly accuse me of being a callous, uncaring SOB. But you're implying that the dying person has some kind of right to my blood. I don't agree with that at all.
Well, why not?
Well, because it's my body. It's mine, all mine. Not a single part of it belongs to the public or the government or to arbitrary strangers, however needy they are. If so, no one else ever has a right to any part of it.
I think you're trying to back me into a corner. You're trying to get me to deny that your body belongs exclusively to you. Okay, you know what? I bite the bullet. I deny it. It's not just your body.
Are you serious?
I'm deadly serious. Go back to the tax analogy. Most people grant that society at large has a moral claim to at least a portion of our private wealth. There's a tricky question about how much. I mean, clearly, it would be wrong to tax people into poverty. But as long as taxation leaves people with sufficient wealth to live flourishing lives, society seems perfectly within its rights to demand, not just to request, John, but to demand that we all make financial contributions to the common good.
Well, so there are limits. You're at least saying that just as the government can't legitimately tax us into poverty, it can't legitimately violate our basic bodily integrity.
That's part of what I'm saying. That's why neither morality nor the state can require that I give up one of my arms, say.
Yeah, but you're also suggesting that as long as the basic integrity of my body is preserved, I can be morally, maybe even legally, required to give up, quote, excess bodily parts, at least if doing that increases the well-being of others.
John, you've got it exactly right. And to carry the analogy a little bit further, think of estate taxes. Just as we confiscate the estates of the wealthy dead, at least part of them, for the common good, maybe we should confiscate the bodily organs of the healthy dead for the common good, too.
The healthy dead. Interesting concept. Well, Ken, I'm not sure I agree with any of this. But you've convinced me that it's maybe not so simple as I thought to say exactly who owns how much of my body and just why. There's some interesting things here to talk about.
And to give us even more to think about, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, out to a city that's trying to regulate its citizens' bodies. She files this report.
In Richmond, California, City Councilman Jeff Ritterman says soda is killing people, or at least it's shortening their lives.
Obesity, type 2 diabetes mellitus, hypertension, premature heart attacks, premature strokes, and cancer. That entire cluster is now definitively linked to the intake of sugar-sweetened beverages.
Ritterman is trying to get voters to pass a penny per ounce soda tax. The tax could be used to pay for nutrition classes and swimming lessons for students to help reduce obesity.
A third of our Latino students, a third of our African American students are obese, and another 20% are overweight in each group. If we do nothing, those children will die young.
Ritterman was a cardiac surgeon for 30 years before joining the city council. He points to a recent study that shows men who drink a can of soda a day are 20% more likely to suffer a heart attack.
It's a product that's literally robbing our children of years of life.
And this small city in Northern California is not the first to try to limit soda consumption.
Supersized drinks like this are the target of a first-of-its-kind ban that New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg wants to impose.
New York City's Board of Health recently voted to ban the sale of soda drinks larger than 16 ounces in movie theaters and restaurants. Of course, many oppose the ban. They say it's government paternalism at its worst. New Yorkers for Beverage Choices is a group of mostly business owners financed by the soft drink industry. Here's a clip from a video on the group's website featuring Teamster Executive Board member Joe Vita.
We ask that the mayor reevaluate this proposed plan and to work with our companies to educate consumers, not eliminate their freedom of choice.
The Center for Consumer Freedom took out a full-page ad in the New York Times with Mayor Bloomberg's face photoshopped on the body of a nanny and the words, "Nanny Bloomberg, you only thought you lived in the land of the free."
The argument about a nanny state, you know, why is this government, isn't this government overreach, isn't this government interference, I think makes only sense when everybody is very well informed. And so we see this as a sort of right-to-know issue, as really using the tax to inform the public.
Ritterman says we aren't really free in our choices anyway. Poor residents may not have healthy shopping options close by and affordable. And the soft drink industry spends a lot of money to make products appealing.
So in a sense, this is counter-advertising. And it's really aimed at just making people healthier. We have nothing to gain here but making the people of Richmond, and particularly our future generation, healthier.
Ritterman believes the tax will change behavior in a way a public education campaign cannot. And he believes government not only has the right, but the duty to protect residents from soda.
If the children in Richmond who are overweight and obese now are not successfully intervened upon, they will not be in a position to coach the Little League, to teach the Sunday school, to do the myriad of volunteer things that any community needs to develop the cohesiveness that builds community.
So in a way, the residents of Richmond, California owe it to their city to stay healthy. And Jeff Ritterman is making sure the city holds them to it. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin, for updating us on the soda wars from New York City to the People's Republics of the East Bay. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're talking about regulating bodies. We're joined now by Cecile Farb. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of Oxford. She's author of Whose Body Is It, Anyway? Justice and the Integrity of the Person. Cecile, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Good morning. Good afternoon, depending on where you are.
Hi, Cecile.
Hi.
Look, the topic of your book is itself very original. I don't think it would occur to most people, or even the most philosophers, to raise the question of who owns our bodies. So tell me, what first led you to ask that question and then to write a whole book about it?
Well, my mother has always given blood 2 or 3 times a year for as long as I can remember. She also thinks that after death, all the parts of her body should be given to people who need them. So I kind of, you know, grew up, you know, with that view that it's absolutely the right thing to do. So when I became a professional philosopher, I thought, well, you know, maybe I should try to argue, you know, for that view. So that's how I got into this, really.
So then tell us, or maybe you already have, but expand on it. Who does own my body? Me? Society at large? Needy strangers? The government?
So I think you own your body, but you don't own it fully, not completely. You know, in some respects, for certain parts of your body, you know, those who need those parts as a matter of life and death have a claim to it.
Wait a minute. Slow down here. We'll get into why they have a claim to it. But it just seems obvious and intuitive that I own my body. I mean, there's two possibilities. I am my body. Most philosophers think that I am not my body, but this psychological continuity thing, I am the person. The person's not identical with the body. But the body belongs to the person who occupies it in a special and intimate way. I don't own John's arm. I own my arm. Don't share that intuition?
No, I don't share that intuition. Suppose, you know, you walk down the street and there is a puddle of water and a baby is drowning in that puddle of water. The only way to save the life of the baby is to lift the baby out of the puddle. You're the only person who can do it. Now, do you think you are morally obliged to do that?
Well, I think it would be a darn callous thing not to do it, and I think I should do it. Maybe I am morally obliged, but why does that show the baby? Well, that doesn't show that the baby owns my body, does it?
It shows that the baby has a claim that you use your arm in a particular way at that particular point in order to save his life. So if you believe that, then you don't believe that you own your body
fully. So let's be clear here. So you said, to say that somebody owns my body in your parts of my body, in your vocabulary, is really to say they have a claim on the use of my body. Not just I have a claim on the use of my
body. That's right.
Well, isn't that a funny sense of ownership? I mean, somebody might have a claim to use my car, you know, because suppose it's the only way that we can get somebody to the hospital and all that. They have a temporary claim on the use of my car, but that doesn't mean they own my car. After they use it to get this person to the hospital, it goes back to me. It's rightful and sole owner.
Yeah, and so I agree, and the same with your arm. Once the baby is rescued, you know, you regain a claim to the use of your arm. So that it's in that one sense that you don't fully own your arm. You can't do with your arm whatever you want at any time.
So in a way, though, you said that we do own our body, but you're saying the ownership of our body is like the ownership of other things, at least in most states. It has limits. I mean, the U.S. Constitution protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures, but it doesn't protect us from reasonable seizures. And
absolutely,
our car can be seized for emergencies.
Absolutely. Yes,
and so
absolutely,
in the same way, our body could be seized for emergencies.
In that way, or think about military conscription. You know, to say you have to fight, you know, in that war is to say, well, we, the community, have a claim on your person, on your body, to fight in that war.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're talking about regulating bodies with Cecile Farb from Oxford.
Are there limits on what I can do with my own body as long as I'm not harming anyone else? Does morality sometimes require me to give others my body parts? By what rights can governments forbid people from doing things like selling their bodily organs or their sexual services?
my body and the rights of others to it, when Philosophy Talk continues.
We're talking about how much control we should have over the fate of our very own bodies. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're asking to what extent we own our own bodies. Do others have any moral right to my bodily parts or bodily services? Or am I master of my bodily domain?
Our guest is Cecile Fabre. She's the author of Whose Body Is It Anyway? Justice and the Integrity of the Person.
So, okay, Cecile,
yes.
It's clear that you believe that a person can actually have the right to expect or demand part of somebody else's body or somebody else's bodily services. Where would such a right come from?
Well, I think we have a right in general, within certain limits, to receive help when we need it, you know, particularly as a matter of life and death. So the welfare state, which is funded through taxation, is one way in which we as a society honor this right. And I just think that, you know, it can be, the argument can be extended, you know, again within limits, to parts of the body,
well,
particularly
let's
after
slow
death.
Down. Slow down. Okay, the welfare state. It redistributes wealth. It takes some from money from some, spends it for the general
That's
good.
Right.
It sometimes
That's
even
right.
transfers money from X to Y, right?
That's right.
Yeah, but money is not like intimately connected with my person and my being. Money, you know, I can have an excess of money that's far more than necessary for my flourishing. You know, Mitt Romney deserves to give us some of his money because he doesn't need all of that money. But arms, legs, eyes, is different.
So arms, legs, eyes, I agree, are different. But I mean, I have an excess of blood. I don't need all the blood that there is in my body now to continue to function. I don't need all the bone marrow that I have to continue to function. I don't need all the liver cells that I have in order to continue to function. So what's the difference with money?
Well, I mean, that's a rhetorical question.
No, I think she means that as a real question.
It's a real question.
Yeah,
it's not rhetorical. It's a real question.
Okay, what's the but let's so the state maybe requires people to give blood if they're healthy. I don't know. I could live with that. Bone marrow is a bit more painful. I could live with that. But let's skip to something really difficult. Kidneys. There's a shortage of kidneys. We all have two kidneys. Most of us who are healthy. Who aren't alcoholics, who don't have various other things, are probably 90% assured that we won't need that second kidney. Do you think the state could start a program of required kidney donation and that would be moral, legal, legitimate, and et cetera?
Well, it depends. No, I don't. I think I will draw the line there because the risks attendant on having a nephrectomy are quite high, and that would have to be, you know, taken into account. I mean, in the book that you mentioned, I restrict, you know, myself to renewable bodily resources as well, which can be extracted either without anesthetics or through local, you know, anesthetics. So I certainly don't believe, you know, that I must give you a kidney of mine if you need one. But I do believe that I must give you some of my blood or my bone marrow if you need it in order to survive. That's my view.
Okay, so just as the state can't take more than 14% of Mitt Romney's wealth or more than 25% of my wealth, it can't take my kidneys. I'm relieved.
Well, right. You mean the analogy with taxation quite seriously. I'm not even sure you mean it as an analogy. I mean, the argument that supports tax schemes, you think that very argument supports, as it were, redistribution of excess bodily parts. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's because I simply don't see what is different in a morally relevant way between money on the one hand and the parts of, you know, our bodies such as blood and so on the other hand. But I also think, to be even more controversial, that after death, we simply do not own our body. So after death, I must make my kidneys available, my liver, my heart, my lungs, my corneas, and so on and so forth.
So I just want to draw an analogy between your view and what I understand to be Ayn Rand's view.
Right.
Because you both see this strong analogy between our ownership of our own body and our ownership of the wealth
yeah.
that we come by. But where you do a modus ponens, she does a modus tollens.
Explain
tolens.
What yes. that is.
Yes.
Explain that
is. Yes.
You say just as our wealth really belongs partly to the state and is for the use of others, so is our body. And she, to
yes.
oversimplify, no doubt, is what is a subtle body of work, says, just as nobody has a right to my
yes.
body or any of my bodily parts, they don't
yes.
have a right to my wealth
yes.
and the things I accumulate.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. So I agree with her that, you know, they are analogous, but I do very firmly believe in taxation. I'm not prepared to give up on that. So my view is, given that I do believe, you know, in taxation, then I have to accept limited rights over the body.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about regulating bodies with Cecile Farb from Oxford University. Alex in Palo Alto's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alex.
Hi, thank you very much. How are you guys doing?
Okay. Hi. What's your comment or question?
In making a point a few minutes ago, I believe it was the gentleman who had said, and this was further to the point that the state has already has a claim on some of your property and the body is somewhat analogous to that. You had mentioned that the somebody could take use of your car in the case of an emergency, and then after the use of the car, the car goes back to you in ownership. I'm wondering where you find the basis for the idea that somebody can use your car or any of your property in the case of a personal emergency.
Well, suppose that somebody's lying dead on the street or dying on the street. There's no ambulance around, Alex, and
sure.
we got to get the person to the hospital. And my car is the only car around, and I could take them to the hospital without any cost to myself. Are you denying that you would feel obligated? I'm not just as an act of charity.
Yes.
Are you denying, Alex, that you would feel obligated to lend your car to that person, as it were?
Oh, I certainly feel like I would love to lend my car, although the state doesn't have any right to the car, and there's no law in the United States that requires somebody to give their car in that situation.
Well, that's certainly true. Cecile, what do you think about that?
Well,
thanks,
so that's interesting. So so I suppose the question is this. Alex, what do you think about requisition of property in general in cases of extreme emergency? So, you know, the police says, we need a car, we've run out of petrol, you know, your car is the only one we can use. You know, we're taking it. Would you object to that?
And under law in most jurisdictions in the United States, police are able to take your car if there's an impending emergency. But to save somebody's life, individual's life, nobody has the right to take your car. And interestingly, no physician has either a moral obligation under the laws that govern physicians in this country, nor are there any state laws requiring somebody to try to save your life.
So these are, Cecile, these are
right.
important questions. In some countries, there are what are called Good Samaritan laws or anti-Bad Samaritan laws, where you are legally
yes.
required
yes.
to help out a person in need when it's not contrary to your needs or desires. But in America, there aren't too many of those laws. Should there be such laws?
Well, is it not the case that there is such a law in the state of Vermont? That's my understanding.
Well, there are some places.
Some places, yeah.
But what do you think about such laws in general? Should there be such laws?
Oh, definitely. I mean, in my home country, which is France, there is such a law of Good Samaritanism. Belgium, you know, has it as well. Britain doesn't. I do think that there should be, you know, such a law. I mean, the case that's always mentioned in this context is the case of Kitty Genovese, that woman who was murdered in the 70s in New York. 34 people heard her call for help in the course of 3 hours. No one helped. She died. I think there should be a law, you know, requiring people, again, within limits, you know, to provide help to those who need it.
Can we distinguish whether one has a moral obligation to do such a thing? It seems to me you might well have a moral obligation to intervene and help in such circumstances
yes.
versus whether the state has the legitimate power to legally require you to do. And not everything that I have a moral obligation
That's
to
right.
do is a legitimate exercise of state power to coerce me into doing it.
No, I completely agree. And in fact, there might be very good arguments for saying, well, you know, the state shouldn't enforce that particular right. You know, arguments to do with effectiveness. How do we get, you know, the relevant information we need, you know, for the state to act? Absolutely. But I do think that, and this is why I disagree with Alex, I do think that there is a moral obligation, a very strong moral obligation, to give our car, to give some blood, to give bone marrow, to make our body available after death.
Well, I'm not sure you disagree with Alex. I think Alex clarified things a little bit. So on the one hand, there's agreement, or at least it seems to be the case, that the state has a right to requisition private property in the case of emergencies. Then there's the question of what counts as an emergency. Does one person dying or one person needing help count as an emergency, or are we talking something about hurricanes, wars, and so forth? Then the other question is there a moral obligation to help that person, even if it comes to the extent of giving blood or bone marrow? I don't think Alex denied that. But those are two separate questions. And where your view is controversial, I think, is that this requisitioning doesn't stop with your car or your petrol. It extends to your blood marrow and your blood, maybe not to your kidney, although it sounds like if we had pretty painless ways of getting kidneys out of people, it might.
Yes, it would extend to kidneys in that case as well. Absolutely.
We've got a lot of callers on the line. Karen in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Karen.
Good morning. I have a question. It's a hypothetical question. In a society, let's say that's a coercive society, using the analogy of the taxation for the common good and body parts for the common good, when it's a society that's coercive, for example, a society, a government that wanted to have a population of males for, let's say, fighting wars, then is it ethical to require that female fetuses be aborted and males be produced, or that even in a more far-reaching scenario that a woman's body be altered to make sure that the children that she bore were males?
Wow, interesting question.
Well, that's a very interesting question. So I would say no. But I don't see the inconsistency between saying no to your question and saying yes to blood, you know, and bone marrow. I mean, you know, to intervene on women's bodies in the way that you've just suggested, you know, let alone to abort, you know, fetuses, is very different from asking people to once a year go and give blood to remedy shortages.
What about another kind of disanalogy? So women's bodies have, let's call it, uses that male bodies don't. Women can bear children. Women could, I suppose, rent out their wombs, but the state, I think, that doesn't criminalize it, but it doesn't let it happen. What about that?
That's interesting, because, I mean, I do think that commercial surrogacy should be permitted. I certainly think it's morally permissible to do it. And, in fact, I also think that prostitution, you know, should be legalized. So it's not as if I think that we don't have certain important freedoms of our body. We do have important freedoms, but we still must give blood, bone marrow, and so on and so forth on a regular basis.
So, as far as I recall, you don't really discuss abortion in your book.
No, I don't.
So I want to return to that, though, not the question of forced abortions, but just the question of abortion. Now, there's a lot of issues that raise an abortion, so why don't we just stipulate for the sake of argument that the fetus is a human being and otherwise entitled to rights. No one has a right to kill it, but somebody might argue, along with Judith Thompson, that a female has a right to remove that live human being from her body. What's your position on that?
Because let me press it a little bit. If the state has an interest in that fetus, and if the state has some ownership of your body, can't the state, as it were, commandeer your womb for nurturing this fetus that it has an interest
kind
in?
Kind of a good Samaritan.
What about that?
Yeah, good. So don't forget that I do say that there are limits to what we can expect people to do, you know, for the sake of others. Now, pregnancy and childbirth are very risky activities, you know, as it were, or conditions. And it seems to me that this is where the risk, you know, to the mother, the simple health risk, you know, to the mother of carrying on with the pregnancy and giving birth, you know, would be too high. I don't think you can expect, you know, people to actually do this. So again, I can say that on the one hand and keep my position on blood, bone marrow, liver cells, and posthumous divesting of organs on the other hand as well.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about regulating bodies with Cecile Farb. We'd love to have you join this conversation. Michael from Richmond's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael.
Hi. One of the things that we need to take into account here is the difference between living in a society in which rights have been created to protect us from a state that we don't trust. And the possibility of living in a genuinely democratic society where money and previous power doesn't influence those decisions, where we might trust the state in a whole different way. And that comes into mind when I think about the fact that the state today claims, and most people accept, the right to take our whole body and put it into a war situation, to draft people now into an army when there's an emergency situation, and to literally make us lose our lives for the sake of the collective, which we might be in favor of in one situation, in a situation where we lived in a genuine democracy, and not now. But what I want to ask is, in relationship to that, is where does the right of individuals to control over our bodies come from? We don't create our bodies. Our parents do. Our parents couldn't do that without the larger social order providing food, medicine, etc. Even as a child, we are only able to survive because we live in a social order that provides us with food and caring of a variety of sorts.
I think that's very interesting. If the view is, well, we're not really responsible for the fact that we have a body, so, you know, how can we even begin to say that we earn it, then I'm somewhat sympathetic, you know, to that view. That's how I, you know, understand the question. But what I want to ask, particular caller is whether he thinks that we have any control at all over our body. And it's not clear to me what he thinks.
Yeah, I want to have control as long as I can't trust others to share that control with. When I live in a class-dominated society in which the government or the we that we're talking about is not a democratic one, doesn't respect the rights of all people equally and treats people unequally, then absolutely I want to fight for that so-called right, whatever that means.
Right.
We get it. In general, your view is that my body isn't fully mine to control and so forth. But in the kind of states most of us live in, where people don't just get drafted in order to protect from invasion, but to go invade other people, they don't have that right. But the problem isn't that they don't have the right because they don't have the right to my body being the state, but because they're an irresponsible state that's doing stupid things with my body.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about regulating bodies with Cecile Farb from Oxford University.
What is the role of the state and the law in regulating bodies? Does the state have any business at all in preventing me from commercializing my own body? Should the state confiscate the organs of the healthy dead in the same way it confiscates the estates of the wealthy dead? Or should we be free to donate or not donate our organs as we see fit?
We'll tackle these questions and more when Philosophy Talk continues.
Well, I have a feeling they wouldn't want my body, but they do want your body. But do they have a right to it? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. Our guest is Cecile Farb from the University of Oxford, and we're talking about regulating bodies. And we have a caller in the line, Amy from Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Amy.
Thank you. I wanted to bring up the concept of two different types of ways that our government regulates drug use. One is deciding that certain recreational drugs are illegal, and so preventing people from using them even if there's no victim. And the other is for enforcing the use of vaccines and saying that children may or may not go to school based on if they have not had certain vaccines.
So what, do you have a question? You just want to know what justifies that?
I was just saying that there is, I was wondering about your guests' reactions to this, in the fact that the government decides things can go in or not go in our body.
Amy's asking, I think, an important question. Look, if as you say, it seems the government has a claim on behalf of the citizenry, because I think you really think it's other individuals that have a call, and then the government can enforce that, then it gets the regulate not just It gets to regulate the care and feeding of my body too, doesn't it? Because, you know, if it's not just yours, if it's not just your car, then you have to take care of it.
No, not at all. On my view, you know, when the state can act to, for example, say you have to give your blood, it does so for the sake of a person, another person who needs, you know, my blood, particularly as a matter of life and death. That's completely different, you know, from the state saying to me, for your own good.
No, wait a minute. Right? But I know that, but not just for your own good. But since I may need your blood, since others may need your blood, right, you have an obligation to care for your blood so that when you're called upon to give it. Well, can't the state do that by your life?
No, I don't think so. So, you know, the state, for example, in my view, cannot force me to take on a particular job which is very high earning and therefore which will make me pay more taxes, you know, for the sake of augmenting my contribution, you know, to the state. Do you see what I mean?
I do see what you mean, but I don't know what the principle that stops the state from having such intrusive powers in your view. It seems to me that if you start down this line, you're going to have a very powerful state. This hectoring helicopter, how did you put it? Hovering, hectoring helicopter parent. What's going to stop the state from becoming a hovering, hectoring helicopter parent?
Well, so I suppose to go back to an earlier caller, it would, you know, depend on which state, in which particular political culture, you know, and so on and so forth. But if the view is, as soon as you start walking down that line, you will never stop, you know, then I, you know, disagree with that. You know, what I'm trying to stake out, you know, is a position whereby there are certain things that, you know, we ought to be able to do to our body. For example, taking recreational drugs. You know, I'm not in favor of legislation against that, but there are certain things that we must do with it as well, which is, you know, help others if we are in a position to help.
Well, so with respect to getting shots, which governments require,
yes.
And drugs, I think it's important to distinguish between what the government in theory has a right to do and what they in fact do. I mean, I think they're pretty reasonable, at least in America, about what shots you have to take, and that they really are shots that basically protect the wider public from certain kinds of contagion. Well, on the other hand, with respect to drugs, there's just, you know, it's bizarre. I mean, you can't smoke pot, but you can drink Coca-Cola, which is probably worse for you.
Yes. No, I agree. I agree.
There are presumably certain drugs that meet the criterion. That is, if you take these drugs, you will be a public menace. Maybe crack cocaine is like that. I don't know. But lots of drugs that are regularly rated certainly aren't. But, I mean, it seems to me that the ones that are like that makes perfectly good sense to not let people take them.
Sissy, I want to shift you to another topic that you've written about and talk a lot about in your book, confiscation of the bodily organs of the dead. Some people think, just as I can leave my estate to my children, I should be able to leave my estate to my children, so I should be able to leave my organs to whomever I want or not leave them to anybody or insist that they not be used. You disagree with that. Why?
Yeah, I do. I do. Well, first of all, you know, I don't think that we have the right to leave our estate in its entirety to whomever we wish. I mean, I firmly believe in inheritance, you know, tax. And again, you know, by analogy, I mean, I do think that, you know, given the shortage of life-saving organs, you know, we don't have the right to hold on, you know, to our body in its entirety after we are dead. It's not useful, you know, to us, that body, after we are dead. And I don't see why my son has a greater claim, you know, over the integrity of my body once I'm dead than someone has a claim to my kidney.
Well, let me, but wait a minute. Would you not, suppose I want to be cremated rather than buried? And I put that in my last will and testament, that I shall be cremated. Don't I mean, it seems right to respect that wish. And if it's right to respect that wish, it seems right to respect my wishes for my body after I'm no longer there to occupy it.
Well, do you think if you were to say, I've got this enormous amount of money in cash in my safe, you know, at the bank, and I want that pile of banknotes to be burnt after I'm dead? Do you think that would be right?
That seems kind of an odd thing to say. You're a very good dialectician.
No, it doesn't matter.
You're like Socrates. Or, you're trying to trap me.
Well,
here.
That's the whole point. No, but I mean, would it be right? You know, for society to say, okay, fine. I mean, you know that you know $3 million in cash, but you know it's his
okay,
wish. Didn't you burn it?
But the money is a resource that can be that does me no good. Oh, I see where we're going with this. Money is a resource that does me no good, but would do society a great deal of good. But my body is my own in a way that my money is not my own.
But
that,
your liver doesn't do you any good after you're dead.
So with the question of the body, I mean, I'm kind of sympathetic to the overall point of view, in spite of the persona I adopted in the introduction. But
right.
But there are so many religious things that come in.
Absolutely.
You know, some people think it's right to burn your body. Some people think it's your body must be kept intact and buried. There's feelings of indignity. I mean, I wouldn't mind people using my organs. Not totally. I sure want my body in an anatomy class. So it gets complicated.
Of course, it does. You know, of course it does get complicated. But you know, first of all, I can't think of any of the mainstream religions. You know, who would disagree with posthumous organ, donations. That's point number one. Point number two, to someone who says, but my religious beliefs require that I should be cremated intact, I would say, well, why should your religious beliefs matter more than the life of another person?
Well, because religion is like the deepest beliefs you have and all that sort of stuff. I don't know. Religion's individual conscience. You know, we're having this big debate in the U.S. about just this very issue these days, about how much does religious conscience trump versus the government's views about what's in the collective interest.
So let me be very controversial here. I mean, I do think that those beliefs are completely irrational, and I don't see why they should be given precedence again over the life of another person. So that's the crucial fact that we must remember. We are talking about lives which will not be saved for the sake of protecting those beliefs.
I want to underline one thing, because it's not exactly clear to me how these two things of your view fit together. On the one hand, you're for the government being able to compel us to do things like donate blood. On the other hand, you're against the government telling us not to commercialize our body, like prohibiting prostitution or renting out your womb for surrogacy. How do those two views fit together?
So one of the things I've said again and again is that there are limits to what we can be required to do, for the sake of others. So, I don't think that one should be forced to give a kidney or a lung or to provide sex for free, against our will. But there might be cases where we would be willing, to do it against payment. So cases where we are not under a duty to give might be cases where we are nevertheless willing to do it against payment.
Yeah, okay, and it's...
Is that clearer?
That's clearer, but why is it wrong of the government to say, you can't sell sex to this guy or gal? Why is it wrong? Does that violate something about my right?
Yes, I think it does. I think it does violate a right that I have, to decide whether or not to treat my body as a commodity. I think that's an important right. It's a decision that only we can actually make.
I'm
looking at it from the point of view of the prostitute here.
So would this extend to selling my kidney and my blood?
Yes, I think it would. I mean, take the case of kidneys. Why should it be the case that the only person in a kidney transplant who is not paid? Everyone is paid, the doctor, the nurses, and so on. Why should the only person who is not paid be the one who gives the kidney?
No, good question. So you've got
question.
A very subtle view here that marries two things. I mean, on the one hand, I got this intuition, and you're challenging both of my intuitions. I think I started out with the intuition, you shouldn't be able to sell your kidney, and nobody should tell you what to do with your blood. Now you're saying somebody should be able to tell you what to do with your blood, and you should be able to sell your kidney. So you're kind of going against the grain on both sides of your view, right?
Yes, I am. Absolutely. I am. I'm very aware of that. But, that's the fun of it.
So compare, I mean, the European civilizations, including America, have a lot in common, but the French have always been more Rousseauian and the British
true.
More Lockean.
And what does that mean? What does that mean?
Does your view reflect that? If so, tell us what it means.
Well, no, that's interesting because although I'm French, as I think you know or would have gathered, I've been in England, you know, for 20 years, and I became a professional philosopher in this country, you know, in Britain. So I think my views do reflect, you know, the more collectivist dimension of philosophy, which you've identified, you know, through Rousseau. But other strands of my view are more Lockean. They're more about, you know, rights that we have against the state to tell us whether, for example, we should, you know, sell sex or not.
Right. The prostitution part of your view, the selling, commercializing, that's Lockean. I own this. I can sell it. The other part is I don't own it exclusively. The government can regulate it. That's more Rousseauian, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, I don't see, I mean, you know, we many people tend to have that view in many other cases. So, you know, in some countries, we have ownership rights of our house, but we do have to pay a tax, you know, on it.
So
we can also sell our house, you know, if we want to.
Cécile, this has been an utterly fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
And I thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Our guest has been Cécile Fabre. She's a professor of philosophy from the University of Oxford. She's author of a fascinating book, Whose Body Is It Anyway? Justice and the Integrity of the Person. So, John, what are you thinking? I thought that was really cool.
Oh, I thought that was fascinating. She combines the kind of Rousseauian perspective of the French with some elements of Locke and the dialectical ability you'd expect from Oxford. I wanted to ask her how come the French, with all the Rousseauian public spiritedness, always cut in line, but we didn't get to that.
Well, you know, my views have really been challenged. She challenged both sides of my intuition. I'm going to have to think about this more. And the way we can do this is continue this conversation on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog. You can also follow us, our tweets on Twitter, and you can find out more by visiting our very active, ever growing Facebook page.
And wait, there's more. Check this out. You can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. And now, a fast-talking man with more than a kidney to spare, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, Pennsylvania Republican Representative Mike Kelly said at a press conference that August 1st, 2012 is a day of infamy right up there with December 7th and 9/11. Why? That's the day required by the Affordable Care Act that insurers must include birth control coverage without a copay. This is an attack on religion, ostensibly, because persons of faith who don't believe in it will have access to birth control against their will. How dare the government force us not to have children for free? In February 2012, then-graduate student Sandra Fluck was not allowed to testify by Republicans in the House Oversight and Government Committee, so she spoke to House Democratic members about the importance of having insurance cover birth control. For this testimony, Rush Limbaugh called her a slut and a prostitute on his radio program, demonstrating the charm and wit that has made him so beloved to millions. And in June, Michigan State Representative Lisa Brown was barred from speaking during a heated debate over abortions after she said, "I'm flattered that you're also interested in my vagina, but no means no." House Speaker James Bolger said this constituted a rape reference, inappropriate in a legislative setting. Now, if you go back to the 60s, you might recall the burgeoning, the personalist political wave of feminism, consciousness-raising sessions, bra burnings, hairy legs, our bodies, ourselves, the joy of sex, the sexual revolution. Women began owning their issues and selves, as therapy speak has it today. Well, I don't own a vagina myself, but it does seem like certain cultural institutions and certain men are once again taking a proprietary interest in it. Women, though, are fighting back. Certainly, Naomi Wolf is leading a feminist charge to reclaim it with her book called Vagina, a Biography, which apparently is a personal journey. It contains the words tantric and goddess, also yoni. It all seems a bit 1970s to me, but maybe we need to go there again. On second thought, that would mean a revival of O Calcutta, a remake of Deep Throat in 3D, and a reissue of Everything You Want to Know About Sex But We're Afraid to Ask. But it may be too late. We're already moving backward to the future. Following her silencing on the legislative floor, Lisa Brown teamed up with two fellow representatives and playwright Eve Ensler to do a reading of the vagina monologues on the Michigan State House steps. Take that as a warning. Please, patriarchal America, give women back their vaginas. Otherwise, the vagina monologues will once again be staged all across the land. America does not need a revival of the vagina monologues. Everybody who really needs to see it has already seen it, and I'm not convinced anybody really needed to see it in the first place. And do we want to see Judy Chicago's The Dinner Party in museums again? I rest my case. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. The director of research is Laura McGuire.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Jimmy Tobin, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation and from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.